Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, August 6, 2019. A lawmaker says rebels of the SPLM-IO attack civilians in Maiwut town.
They shot the civilian and they loot the property and they took all the cattle and also they killed the civilian because the governor came to collect cattle from the community in order to enrich himself. So the community refused it.
And basketball superstar Lual Deng is in South Sudan to inspire young men and women to use sports for career development.
We believe that this is a tool that we can use not just for basketball, but it's a way of getting scholarships and going to high schools and getting a better education. And it's also a tool to take kids, off the streets.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Officials at South Sudan's Ministry of Humanitarian Affairs say an unknown number of civilians have been killed and more than 40,000 others displaced in Maiwut County in Upper Nile region during an ongoing clashes between armed civilians and rebels of the SPLA-IO loyal to Riek Machar. Lasuba Memo reports for VOA from Juba.
The undersecretary in the Ministry of Humanitarian Affairs says the humanitarian situation in Maiwut is dire. Gatwech Peter Kulang says he has received several distress calls from aid agencies in the area appealing for urgent intervention.
The fighting has been going on even this morning. We were told the fighting continues and we just monitor it on the humanitarian aspect. I received a lot of phone calls since yesterday and today on how we can coordinate with our humanitarian wing.
Kulang says the fighting has forced thousands of women, children and elderly to flee from Maiwut town to swampy areas.
Up to now, we have received reports of 45,000 civilians that are affected in Maiwut town. Most of them, they have relocated in an area called Dobdob, Jotom, Maiwut 2, and another place called Meth, up to this moment, there are a lot of movement of civilians.
Last week, a group of lawmakers representing Maiwut County at the Transitional National Legislative Assembly accused forces loyal to Riek Machar of attacking civilians in Maiwut. The lawmakers allege that Pal Kun Kek, the SPLA-IO shadow governor of Adare State, ordered rebel forces to attack Maiwut town. The lawmakers allege that Pal Kun Kek, the SPLA-IO shadow governor of Adare State, ordered rebel forces to attack Maiwut town. Mut Chol is a member of parliament representing Maiwut in the Transitional Legislative Assembly. He says SPLA-IO rebels raided Maiwut village.
They shot the civilian and they loot the property and they took all the cattle and also they killed the civilian because the governor came to collect cattle from the community in order to enrich himself. So the community refused it. This is what brought fight between civilian and fighting rebel.
SPLA-IO spokesperson Colonel Lampol Gabriel confirmed the attack on Maiwut village by rebels. He says SPLA-IO forces have been ordered to pull out of the town, adding that the leadership of the rebels, loyal to Riek Machar, are yet to establish the root cause of the fighting. He claims calm has returned to the area and SPLM-IO shadow governor Pal Kun Kek was fired on Monday. He says a caretaker shadow governor has been appointed to restore peace in Adare State.
What I know is clashes happened, but our forces have been ordered to cease fire and have been told to go back to their location, their current bases. In through and mess and but what led to the cause of the fight, I don't have details about that. And casualties, just so how many were killed and how many got injured, I don't have. And also the SPLA-IO decided to appoint a governor, caretaker governor, a brigadier, to take charge of Adare State.
Lawmaker Chol says the fighting flared because the civilians were trying to protect their property from SPLA-IO rebels who were on a looting operation in the village. South Sudan in Focus could not independently confirm the claims by Lam and Chol. For VOA News, I am Nasuba Memo in Juba.
Peacekeepers and human rights experts are helping girls in Malakal to learn life-saving skills needed for survival in conflict areas. Women and girls have been victims of 5 years of fighting between government and opposition forces in Malakal, as Carol Van Damme reports from Washington.
Human rights groups say sexual violence and other forms of gender-based violence are common violations in areas plagued by ongoing conflict and are even more frequent during post-conflict periods. UN peacekeepers, human rights specialists, and gender-based officers have organized a number of self-defense classes and capacity-building exercises to minimize sexual violence against women and girls in South Sudan. One such class was held in late June at the United Kingdom Engineering Task Force base in Malakal. Girls from Malakal Town and the UN-run Protection of Civilians site camp learned about various strategies for staying safe. UN Protection Advisor Tara Sadvassian, who took part in the training exercise, says the girls learned things like traveling in small groups and staying off the main roads are a good idea.
Even if it is a longer way, you use the way where more people are there rather than a lonely path. That is on a, how do you say, an academic side. Training, a skill training, how they can extricate themselves, put a space between them and the perpetrator.
One of the girls who participated in the self-defense training in Malakal was asked to come up front and share her experiences with the rest of the group. Sadvassian says she also got a chance to speak with the governor, who was in attendance.
She said, Governor, we face a lot of problems, protection issues. We need protection, especially women and girls, and we need opportunities.
Sadvassian says during the 5.5-year conflict, most men were gone. They were either fighting with the government forces or rebel fighters or were dead. And that left women and girls to fend for themselves.
For conflict-related sexual violence, our target is also the uniformed persons, like both SSPDS and the IO, forming the security organs of both the government and the IO. We actually engage with them regularly. They are both SSPDF and Riek Machar IO have come up with a plan of action.
Sadvassian says rights groups have seen a change in attitude from government and rebel officials about combating the problem since March, when they began holding awareness training across South Sudan.
We have covered all the senior officials, and for IO, they signed it last week, and we hope to work with them. But those trainings and sensitization do help that they are open to discuss these issues. And as I said, from a denial to, the stance that they will take action.
Sadvassian says she and other protection advisors have established good communication channels with both sides. She says government and rebel commanders acknowledge there is a lack of training that leads to gender-based violence, so they welcome this new kind of training.
We are not able to talk to everyone, so we target the senior most officials, the commanding officers. We also have made them sign undertaking that they, they will not commit and they will ensure that their forces do not do that on the ground.
In the months ahead, Sadvassian says her group will be focused on providing training at cantonment sites and training teachers so that they can identify when there are problems and report it to the proper authorities. Carol Van Damme for VOA News, Washington.
Sudan's rulers and the main opposition coalition, the Forces of Freedom and Change, have reached an agreement paving way for a new transitional government. The deal provides for a joint civilian-military council to oversee the formation of a transitional cabinet and parliament to govern for 3 years until elections can be held. Joseph Sigley, director of research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, spoke to VOA's senior analyst Mohammed Al-Ashanawi about the prospect of a successful transition to democracy, according to the deal.
I think the prospects remain very tenuous. While there has been some effort made to put together a division of responsibilities and address some of the details of what a power sharing agreement would look like, there's still a lot of questions. The agreement set up three councils, a sovereign council, a legislative council, and a council of ministers. But division of responsibilities between these different councils is unclear. Moreover, the military will be able to appoint the leader of the sovereign council, which is seen as the main power-wielding authority, at least for the first 21 months. And so it remains unclear just how these actions are going to translate into further democratic change. I think some things we're going to want to look for are just how respected certain democratic rights that were spelled out in the agreement are being upheld on the ground. You know, rights of assembly, rights of expression, freedom of press, the continued restoration of internet access, those types of things I think will be some signals to whether there is some continuing commitment to the transition.
With such a long transitional period, the momentum of street protesting could fade out. Is there any threat of a counter-revolution in Sudan given the power of the military?
I think it's very real that there can be counter-revolution. In fact, it's not apparent to me that the revolution has fully come to pass. And the military has held the key levers of power all along, and they continue to do so. And it isn't apparent to me that they have resigned themselves, that they are going to have to genuinely share power. All along in these negotiations, there's been a sense that they are at least verbally agreeing to some sort of power sharing. But in practice, that hasn't yet come to pass. In the end, they always have insisted that they hold the supreme position of whatever transitional arrangement has been under discussion. And so it isn't clear that the military, who has effectively been ruling Sudan for the past 30 years, has accepted the need to share power and to ultimately transition power to a civilian.
That's Joseph Stigley, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with my colleague Mohammed El-Shenawi about the prospect of a successful transition to democracy in Sudan. South Sudanese basketball star Luol Deng is encouraging young men and women to take career in sports. Deng, who concluded a five-day visit to South Sudan today, says he believes sports can avail opportunities that could change lives in South Sudan. Winnie Chirino reports for VOA from Juba.
The NBA basketball star says he is in Juba to supervise the activities of Luol Deng Foundation. He says he constructed the Manute Ball basketball court in Juba 4 years ago to pay tribute to the former NBA star, late Manute Ball, so that his legacy is remembered by generations of South Sudanese. Deng says his foundation is coaching more upcoming basketball players in South Sudan.
We have a program now that's growing and is getting bigger. We are very proud of it. We know there's a lot of more work. The vision is to make it bigger. We are hoping, I don't know when, but we are hoping to hopefully create an academy. But it's something that we see the success that the kids are having from it. And it's something that is beautiful to share with everyone.
Deng says his foundation has built basketball courts in Awil State, Kakuma refugee camp in Kenya, and Wau. He says his foundation has been sending 10 South Sudanese doctors every year abroad for additional training in surgery. He says basketball can also help many South Sudanese develop a career.
We believe that this is a tool that we can use not just for basketball, but it's a way of getting scholarships and going to high schools and getting a better education. And it's also a tool to take kids off the streets, but also occupy them with teamwork, teach them, you know, how to work together, how to communicate.
15-year-old Malong Malual is among the beneficiaries of the Luol Deng Foundation. Malual says the foundation brought him from Rumbek to Juba 2 years ago, and he has completed his senior secondary school.
Luol Deng Foundation is the one who brought me from the village when I was, I do play in village by then. So they went and they see how I play good, and when they brought me to the city and they sponsored me, and they are the one taking my recommendation.
16-year-old Geldrud Ring, another basketball player, says the Luol Deng Foundation has helped him learn other skills.
It kind of made me a better person, like kind of improved my leadership skills. Like, you know, sometimes I'm the captain, I'll be the captain of a team, and, you know, got to lead people. Communication, my communication skills have improved, you know, talking to my teammates. I got to know a lot of people. Like, I have now, like, a wide range of friends right now.
18-year-old Fiona Richard says she learned to play basketball while in primary school. She says she was lucky to travel up to Texas in the U.S., for trainings and received international scholarships.
I played when I joined senior one. I studied senior one, then senior two, I got a bursary like scholarship for also games. I went to Kenya. I was there for 1 year. I got another bursary also in another school in Uganda. By then, it was 2017. I played in Uganda 2018. We went like secondary school. They call it East Africa Games over. Yeah, so we went, it was in Rwanda, 2018, in August. So we went there, we played, and we won the trophy for the school. So this year, I decided to come back to my county.
Deng says his foundation will increase the number of women in its programs and create a platform that connects and unifies all South Sudanese in the diaspora. For VOA News, I am Winnie Serino in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we take a look at the fight against HIV and AIDS in Botswana. Stay tuned.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
how has technology impacted your life?
When I want information, I just pick my phone. I just go to Google, and all the information that I want, I get it just right where I stand.
It made me to be so social to people, like on Facebook. I've known so many people, knowing how they are going on in life, and also on WhatsApp, chatting with my friends.
It's educative to me as well, because if I need to know something about history, something about a disease, something about some medicine, I just go and read about it online.
When I need information, I don't necessarily have to go to the library. All I need to do is just pick up my tablet and I Google whatever I want to know about whilst in the comfort of my home.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011 and we'll get back to you. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. In today's health segment, we take a closer look at the fight against HIV and AIDS in Southern Africa. A test and treat HIV program is bearing fruit in Botswana after the South African country recorded suppression of the virus among participating community. But the deadly virus prevalence remains among the highest in the world, according to a recent study by the Botswana Harvard Aid Institute Partnership. Dube reports for VOA from Gaborone.
21-year-old Tlotlo Mwilwa was born with HIV and orphaned at age 10 after losing both parents to the virus that causes AIDS. But thanks to Botswana's well-developed anti-retroviral therapy program, Mwilwa remains healthy.
There are programs that are out there that are given to people who are HIV positive. What I can say about our government is that it is so supportive. They are always there to support us.
One such program, Test and Treat, showed increased viral suppression and a 30% reduction in new HIV infections among 15 communities in a study group. Test and Treat was set up in 2016 with the help from the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, PEPFAR, to treat all HIV patients regardless of their viral load. Dan Kron Seleka of PEPFAR Botswana says a key aspect of the program's success is community health workers making sure that every HIV patient went for treatment.
And the sooner that people are put on treatment, the sooner that the virus is suppressed within their body, and they may not be able to pass on the virus to others.
The New England Journal of Medicine in July published the study led by researchers from Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health and the Botswana Harvard AIDS Institute partnership. Richard Matlare of Botswana's National AIDS Coordinating Agency says the country has the world's third highest HIV prevalence, with 1 in 4 adults between 15 and 49 HIV positive.
We haven't won the war as yet. If we look at the cohort of our adolescent girls and young women, 40 new infections per week to us are far too high.
For HIV patients like Muilwa, who was born before prevention of mother-to-child transmission efforts, Botswana's progress in the fight against AIDS gives hope for a future with healthy children.
I am not in a relationship. Absolutely. God is so going to bless me with a family.
Botswana aims to have 95% of those infected with HIV know their status, be on treatment, and achieve viral suppression by next year. Mqondisi Dube for VOA News, Gaborone.
Ten South Sudanese Mandela Washington fellows who spent weeks visiting and working at various American institutions say they have learned how to be professionals. Denis Denya, Peter Garangor, Kiden Zaida Ibrahim, and Chol Duang Chan Duang came to VOA to share their experience in the United States. We'll open this discussion with Kiden Zaida Ibrahim, manager at OK Africa Foundation, a nonprofit based in Juba.
There are things I came with. They were in me, but I really want to leave them back. I want to leave them in the U.S. I'm not going with them back to South Sudan. Like, I saw so much respect for pedestrians. Like, you walk, you are the king. The car stands 300 meters away, and then I walk. Let me tell you one thing. Only 2 cars passed rudely since I came for 6 weeks. In South Sudan, 2 cars will wait for you. The rest have passed. You can't cross the road. So I'm going to go back and never rush when I'm driving. I will wait, and then I will also respect people's opinions. I won't force what I think. I mean, everyone is... I used not to be like that. I mean, if you're wrong, I will insist that you're wrong. But I'm going back and I will know no one is wrong. We just have different opinions. And another thing, so like Peter was saying, for me, first, I don't know English. So I'm just struggling with English. It was really hard for me because when I came, I'm talking, no one understands me. And I'm going to stick to our food. I want to leave burger. I want to leave everything here. Let me tell you, Tanza, I went to the restaurant and they said, I said I want a burger, beef burger, because I felt this was going to be so simple. These people started asking me which bread I want. I still chose the bread. As if that was not enough, they said, which cheese? I'm like, okay, how many types of cheese? American, da, 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 da. Okay, give me the first one. And then I chose, which beef? Beef is beef. How many types of beef do you have? So I'm going back home. I'm going to stick to our food. I don't want to go with the American food.
That's quite an experience. And, you know, when I first came here, I decided not to eat out because I don't know the type of food that is out there. So let me hear from Dennis. What is your experience then? If you go back home and you're given an opportunity to address Yali fellows who are coming back, who are going to come to America, our prospective Yalu fellows, what would you tell them?
To me, I think what I would tell the Yalu fellows who are aspiring to come on this program would be that they should really, really understand why they want to come on this program, because the program is about how you will change lives back in the country. And it's not just coming here to have fun, coming here to walk through tall buildings in New York or in Washington. It's about coming here to experience how America has moved, you know, to this stage in the world, so that you can also try to see how best you can reflect this experience in your home countries, in your home communities from which you come. And the first thing I will do when I arrive in South Sudan is to host a yearly workshop where I will invite all yearly members and those who actually want to apply for this program and speak to them about how much change this can bring in your lives. Thank you.
Peter?
Thank you so much. I actually think if I'm to speak, remember the whole of this is about Mandela legacy, and we all know what Mandela means to Africans and even the world, working for someone. And what I will tell them is that there is a lot to be a servant leader. That quote alone will make you believe in yourself and begin pushing for the better of the community. Will make you believe whenever you are on the table of the policies, those policies should be people-centered and then future-oriented.
All right, Zaida.
Yes, if I have to say something about Yali, I think I'm one lucky person. Some people tried many times and they didn't come, and I tried once and I came. So if I have to talk from my perspective, which I should do, is that you should focus on grassroots people, focus on people who need help. So you should change lives. So you cannot go somewhere where there is no need. So someone out there, if you're a young person, identify a need and then do something about it.
All right, Dennis, your story is mixed. You say you're a musician, you're an entrepreneur, and you are also into, business. So if you are going to talk to other people who have the same mind like you coming to the United States, what would you tell them?
Just to pick up from where Zaire said, for the Yali program, they are focusing on people who really know who they are. Like, you should believe in yourself and that you're doing something for the community, because that is where the fastest step begins. If you don't know who you are and what you want to really do and what your vision, what your dream is, then it's very hard for even to get through the application. Just as you said, I was one of those who applied twice and I didn't go through. Why? Because I didn't have a clear picture. I was just excited, like, wow, this is an opportunity. I need to apply for it. I didn't know what exactly is required of me. I needed to be a leader. I needed to influence someone somewhere, and that would qualify me in a way. So it's important that if anyone is interested, for sure you need to know who you want to be and what you really focus on in your life.
That's Dennis Denya, Peter Garangor, Kiden Zaida, and Chol Duang Chang Duang, Mandela Washington Fellows, who came to our studio to talk about their experience in the United States.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202-630-8011 and we'll get back to you. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202-630-8011.
If you're listening to us from Bor, Rumbek, Yambio, and Meridi, we would like to hear from you. Our WhatsApp number is +1 202-630-8011. That's our show for this Tuesday. We now take you to Yambio with Sweet J singing about Tong Tong. We've been listening to a taste of traditional Zande music. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Remember to join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.